Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
Oh, you know, I'm actually doing okay. The session is, you know, the worst parts of the session are over. And so we are now into the veto period, and that's really what we're going to be talking about. Pretty much the damage is mostly done. So that is what we will be talking about this week. The budget is probably the main thing that we'll spend the most time on. But I think the thing that actually made more news than what did pass are the things that didn't pass. And so Jasmine's going to be talking to us about that. All the bills that were left kind of on the cutting room floor, things that didn't pass this week. So basically anything that the governor has the ability to veto if they do pass it after the veto period is over. So, you know, Andy Beshear typically is aligned with you know, how we think about many things. And so I feel like most of the bad stuff will get vetoed if it does pass. And then lastly, I will talk about some of the things that did pass, the things that we probably want to mention at least. And then there will be a couple of very short quick hits at the end. So, Jasmine, you ready?
Yes.
All right,
let's talk about the damage.
Let's talk about the damage or the budget. Both of those things are probably about the same. So, yeah, the budget, the thing that the legislature is required to do is pass a budget. I think that's like the only thing they're actually constitutionally required to do. And as with the rest of the legislation, it was maybe a little bit of good mixed with a lot of bad. Just in terms of process and reminder, the budget bills were approved in very different versions by both chambers. So the House passes a budget to start. It goes to the Senate. It gets altered quite a bit. They pass it, and then it goes to what's called a free conference committee where they're allowed to negotiate and put anything they want to in it. And that is basically they come to an agreement, and then it goes to both houses, and then they pass it. So that's kind of how this thing works all the time. And you know, the House had passed their version. The Senate had passed their version. And then last week, we did get the free conference committee report, and both chambers did pass the budget.
I'm glad you always tell me that, because I need to be reminded every 2 years of how they do it, honestly.
It is deeply confusing, for sure. And also, just as a reminder, the budget this year took the form of two different bills. There was HB1, which included a lot of single-time projects for infrastructure, local items, and stuff, and then HB6, which was our traditional executive branch budget. So HB1 ended up costing about $2.5 billion. That's larger than the original cost of $1.7 billion that was in the House's original budget for these kind of one-time projects that were being spent out of the rainy day fund. Highway and water infrastructure projects were probably the biggest chunk of – well, they were. They were the biggest chunk of HB1. Not probably. We're talking in terms of certainties now. They totaled about $800 million. The next biggest item was $230 million in extra pension payments to try to help us catch up on our pension payments. And then there were lots and lots and lots and lots of smaller projects. I want to, you know, just highlight the type of stuff that's in this. There was $25 million for a conference center in Ashland, $18 million for upgrades to the Kentucky Horse Park, $4 million for the ongoing operations of the Louisville Ballet. Nope, the Louisville Orchestra, excuse me. The ballet did not get their money. So the orchestra got their money. And then $400,000 for the Louisville Science Center. Stuff like that. That is the type of thing that we are looking at this in this budget. In this HB1 extra spending like document. Okay, here's how I feel about this. I think it's great that we're funding the projects that we have in HB1. I think spending on amenities is totally appropriate for a state that's flush with cash right now. We should spend money to make things cool and nice. However, there are a lot of needs we left unmet in this budget. So it's a bit of a bitter taste to see money going towards, you know, conference centers and local projects when we, you know, need to pay for childcare. We need to pay for schools. And those things aren't necessarily getting funded like they should. And one other thing about this is none of these costs count towards the income tax triggers, and we'll get to that at the end of the session, but it is a little bit like just cheating. They're cheating in order to be able to lower our taxes for this kind of stuff. So that's kind of the thing about HB1. Last thing just about HB1 is that something really crazy happened with it there at the end. This was uncovered by the Herald Leader. I think Austin Horn over there is the first person that pointed this out. So a $200 million project that was included in HB1 was for local governments to match grants that came from the federal government, and it was funded towards the Department of Local Governments. And that's kind of the way this thing is laid out, is like a $200 million appropriation to the Department of Local Governments for the doing this of that or whatever. And that's kind of the way it was laid out. They gave $200 million to the Department of Local Governments. And that makes sense because it's a local government project. However, the legislature stripped the program that they intended to fund away from the governor's office and towards the Department of Agriculture, which is, you know, of course, run by a Republican, but then failed to update this language in HB 1. So it should have said, like, $200 million is funded to the Department of Agriculture for the execution of this program or whatever, but they left it in there as the Department of Local Governments. So I think this is really indicative, a really wonderful example about how this Republican legislature operates. It's extremely petty, taking this project away from the Department of Local Governments, where it very obviously should be held, moving it to the Department of Agriculture just for partisan political reasons and the fact that Andy Beshear runs the Department of Local Governments. And then being very sloppy, they rushed changes at the very end of the session without giving them enough time to check their work. And so this is now in a bill that is going to the governor's office, you know, to sign that obviously is mistaken because of a former bill that was passed. So that's HB 1. Jasmine, any questions about HB 1 before we move on to HB 6?
No questions so far.
All right, no questions. That's good. I actually have a question about HB 1 that I don't know the answer to, and that's that the governor, you know, has veto power and he has line item veto power over the budget. I do not know if he has line item veto power over HB 1. Again, it probably doesn't matter because they're just going to override all of his vetoes. But it will be very interesting to see what he line item vetoes if he can in HB 1. All right, moving on to the things that are in HB 6. As you've hopefully heard already, the governor suggested significant raises be mandated in the budget for teacher salaries. The legislature then decided not to include any of those in their budget. So when we're talking about education, I think that's like the main piece of news that I think most people know about in terms of what's going on here. That is probably the first thing to think about. Other education issues. After the full negotiation was completed, the SEEK funding is going to increase by 3% during the next fiscal year and then 6% in the second year of the biennium. So KY Policy actually wrote a really nice write-up of the budget, and I really encourage everybody to check that out. And their report said that this amount is about 26% below 2008 levels. And they say that mostly because of these. It's extremely confusing, but the way that the legislature calculates their funding is one of the ways they calculate funding is through this tier one mechanism, which basically allows for smaller school districts to assess more in taxes, but the mechanism doesn't actually allow for larger school districts to make much more money when they change the calculation in tier one. So because even though they did increase the top line SEEK number, most of the increase is going to go towards smaller districts, and larger districts like JCPS and Fayette County Public Schools are actually not going to be able to raise their amount as much. And of course, that's where the largest chunk of spending occurs. So it is going to still be about 26% below 2008 levels, despite an across-the-board increase that will fall disproportionately. The increase will accrue mostly towards smaller school districts. If you want more details on that, you should read their report, and it's extremely complicated, and that's on purpose. The legislature ended up not substantially changing the funding for transportation that was in the House's original budget that we talked about several weeks ago. They had claimed that the levels of transportation funding represented 90% of the required amount for the first year of the biennium and 100% of transportation funding in the second year of the biennium. But again, KY Policy in their report pointed out that the baseline for those calculations, so when you're saying 90% and 100%, that has to have a denominator. Your numerator is the amount that you're funding, and the denominator is how much you're expected to fund. But those are actually based on 2023 costs. And, you know, if you used 2024 costs, which we do have, the funding ratios would be 74% and 82%. You know, transportation costs are going up, and using 2023 numbers instead of 2024 numbers are a way to just kind of juice your apparent contributions while while not actually funding what is needed. And you know, especially in when so much of the conversation has been around JCPS and its transportation issues, the fact that, you know, we aren't doing what we can to catch that up and to solve that problem really is indicative of some of the later things that we will talk about. One bright spot in the budget was higher education. The amount of funding and the performance-based higher education funding did double. There's a $100 million pool typically, and that had been in the previous budget, and now there will be a $200 million per year pool. So that's great. That's good to double that amount of money. One thing I do recall, Jasmine, I don't know if you remember this, but when the performance-based program was unveiled, and this was during the Bevin administration, smaller public universities were extremely worried that the funding would be skewed towards UK and U of L. And I don't know if that actually happened, but I do remember that they were very anxious about that. Do you remember that at all?
I honestly don't remember much about the program.
Yeah, I think it was it was based around these metrics that they said, you have to achieve these goals. And I think they were around achievement and enrollment and all these kinds of markers. And I think that the concern was that it was much easier for larger school districts or larger institutes of higher education to achieve those metrics. And I don't know if that did eventually happen. One piece of consternation about higher education was in capital projects. UK and U of L both received their top requests. I don't remember exactly what those were, but the state did not give Kentucky State University in Frankfurt its top request. They had asked for a health science center. Senator Damon Thayer said that KSU had produced poor results and called the school lucky to get taxpayer dollars. Derek Graham, who is an alum of KSU who represents Frankfurt, said, quote, "They deserve what they request, just like the other comprehensive universities. Kentucky State is part of this commonwealth," unquote. I think it's a really bad look for Damon Thayer to say that kind of thing about Kentucky State, Kentucky's, historically black public university.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has struggled. We've talked about
this. Right. They've certainly had their issues, but to single out our, main predominantly black college.
Yeah, predominantly black public college for sure. We've talked about it before. They've had to be bailed out before, and the way in which the state did that was extremely paternalistic. They have gotten into trouble with some of these issues in the past. It is just kind of, I don't know. That is a thing that happened. They did get some sort of capital project approved. I think it had to do with I don't remember. They got some sort of capital project approved, but it was not their request. And that kind of also goes to the paternalism. You don't get what you actually requested. You get, what we think you need. Okay, state workers, they're going to receive a modest 3% raise. That might keep up with inflation this year. It probably won't, but it might get close. The governor's budget called for providing our retirees, a 13th check. So, you get one check a month in your retirement, or your direct deposit or whatever. And historically, the state had provided the state with what they call a 13th check. It's basically 1/12 of your pension again, as a bonus. And seniors and these retirees, many of them exist on a fixed income. They have their pension, they have their Social Security, and that's what they have. You don't really have the ability. I guess you could go out and work at McDonald's or get a job doing something else, but they're older typically and don't want to do that. They've also served their time in a public space. So bonuses are really, really nice for retirees. The governor included this. The House did not include it originally. The Senate slotted it back in, and then they had negotiations, and the extra check was not included, mostly so that the state could meet that income tax trigger, which, again, we will get into in just a second. So that really sucks for retirees, and I'm sorry that happened. We could afford it. We could make it happen. We just didn't. This budget provides about $30 million in new funding for prosecutors and county and Commonwealth attorneys' offices across the state, and nowhere near that in commensurate funding for public defenders. Jasmine, are you surprised by this?
I'm not surprised. A few years ago, we used to have bipartisan support for some criminal justice reform, and Republicans who were at least supportive of the constitutional rights of the accused. And so they supported public defenders in theory. And now that seems to have just gone away.
Yeah, I think that is borne out in this budget. That's for sure. Another kind of just petty thing that happened is that the budget caps at $75 million, the amount that can be spent on natural disasters. Of course, you can go into special session and appropriate additional money from the legislature, but that takes time. It's, you know, even if you call the legislature into session, you know, the next day they have to do three readings of a bill in each chamber, and you really can't pass anything until like 4 days later. So, you know, if we do have a disaster, I hope it's not a big one, because then your amount that you can spend is capped. So that is that. That was mostly just because they were upset that the governor had gotten too much good press about his response to disasters. So got to curb his ability to respond to them, I guess. So that is all of the major things I wanted to talk about that are included in the budget. I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking a little bit about this trigger mechanism. In many ways, the entire budget is designed to meet the trigger mechanism, which, you know, was set up back in 2022 to eliminate Kentucky's income tax. And again, you know, Jasmine, you said you appreciated my reminders. Here's another one. The triggers essentially say that if income exceeds expenses by a certain amount while the rainy day fund remains healthy, the legislature is then obligated to consider a half point reduction in income taxes, and that's supposed to happen over a longer period of time so we can, you know, be on sound financial footing while we cut taxes. There's a lot of reasons this doesn't make sense, because typically, like, the economy turns quickly, and then when you really need the money, if it's not there, it's not there, and then you don't have the ability to make it back. If things are flush, they're flush, and you know, having a baseline tax rate makes sense in terms of being able to meet your fiscal obligations. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about these triggers and its impact on the budget this year. In order to achieve these triggers, which, you know, the government did not achieve the trigger last year. In order to achieve the trigger this year, the state decided against funding things like daycare, more SEEK money, more you know, education money, more teacher pay, extra pay for retirees. That 13th check, they did not have much. If they did have some funding for you know, additional public housing or additional housing issues, the low income housing funds and stuff, but not nearly what we needed. We could have paid a heck of a lot more, and there were a lot of other things. And the reason they kept spending on those things down was so that they could achieve that trigger mechanism. An especially stupid thing is that the state has opted to bond a lot of the capital projects that were included in the budget instead of paying for them outright. You could just pay cash. If anybody's been in the real estate market, you know that paying cash gives you quite a bit of an advantage, not the least of which is that you don't have to pay interest on a loan. And also, it's just like easier for you to negotiate with your partners. The people who you're buying from are the things that you are trying to purchase. You know, it's much easier to do that. The state decided to bond these things to create debt for themselves that they will have to pay back and pay a premium on, just so that they, you know, can achieve these triggers. So essentially, in order to reduce our income in the long term, we have to reduce our income in the short term by paying interest. So it's just like extremely financially stupid, all in service of this kind of right-wing political view that we need to pay less in taxes. Chad All, who's a state representative, had a really great quote about this from the floor. He said, quote, "We have decided as a body our top priority is to hit these artificial triggers so that we can cut the income tax. It's not our schools. It's not our kids. It's not the citizens of the Commonwealth of Kentucky," unquote. So, you know, that is that. Jasmine, do you understand why this is extremely stupid? Is this making sense?
Yeah, we basically had to like do a lot of intentional work to hit the triggers to do this.
Yeah, we and there's like so many things that we needed, right? We need to pay more for daycare. Like, there was a lot of research done. There was a $600 million. You will get to this. You know, you will get to some of this in your what didn't pass segment. But like, there was a pretty significant funding for preschools and daycares that did not pass because we would not have achieved those triggers. Andy Beshear put on the table that 13th check and the Senate went along with it. The negotiations pulled it out because we would not hit the triggers if we got to that. You know, there were things like the diaper tax. There were things like there were things that the state needs to spend money on in order to make our state better that are certainly larger needs than things like a conference center in Ashland or the ongoing expenses for the orchestra, which are good projects. I'm glad that those are going to occur. We could have afforded to do both of those things. We would just not have met the trigger mechanism. We would have had to keep income taxes where they are. I don't think our income tax is exceedingly high. I haven't done my taxes yet this year. I need to do that this week. So maybe I'll be singing a different tune next week. But I doubt it. I doubt it. I don't think our tax rate is exceedingly high. I think that we can afford it. I think our state's citizens can't afford to pay the amount in taxes that we do, and we just didn't because, you know, we want to continue to lower them for ideological purposes, and that means a lot of things that we need aren't going to get funded. Last thing I want to say is that the budget did pass. The politics of it, mostly Democratic opposition, especially in the House, but there were a lot of Liberty Wing Republican Party members who opposed it. So the representatives who opposed it were Representatives Doan, Maddox, Rayburn, Massaroni, Calloway, Proctor, and Rawlings. Those are most of the Liberty Wing, right, Jasmine? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's that. And then in the Senate, Senator Southworth, who is the biggest Liberty person in the Senate, she opposed it there. In the Senate, Democrats all decided to support the budget, and in the House, only Democratic representatives Tackett, Lafferty, and Bojanowski voted for the bill. All of the other Democrats voted against it or didn't vote on it. All right, that's 20 minutes on the budget. Jasmine, what didn't pass during the legislative session?
Okay, so I'll start with probably the biggest and maybe most surprising bill that didn't pass, which is Senate Bill 6, which is like the anti-DEI bill, like the Diversity and Equity Initiatives bill. So when this bill went to the House, it was basically gutted and replaced with a committee substitute with language from Jennifer Decker's House version that came down much harder on DEI than Mike Wilson's Senate version that kind of mirrored Tennessee's language in their bill. Jennifer Decker's version was much more strict. Decker wouldn't answer if the Senate sponsor, Mike Wilson, supported the changes. And Mike Wilson wasn't there that day and like couldn't present the bill. So this all happened without him there. And so things got weird and it didn't get across the finish line. And so that bill is likely dead because when we come back from the veto period, anything that passes, the governor can veto and it can't be overridden. And I think the governor would certainly veto this bill because he has expressed support for diversity and equity offices and initiatives. So I'm surprised that this one didn't make it. And it seems like it's because of the House's shenanigans.
Yes, I talked a little bit about this when it happened. It is kind of wild. I kind of wondered how it would sort out, and it just turned out that it didn't sort out. This was a really high priority for the Republican legislature going into the session. It was like one of the first things we talked about. These are really high numbered bills. It's SB6, and one of the higher House bills as well. And, you know, it just goes to show you that just because they're Republicans doesn't mean they all agree on these kinds of things. It worked out for us, though, in the end. And another thing, Jasmine, I wonder, you know, this isn't going to be as big a deal next year, I don't think. It feels like kind of like a flash in the pan that Republicans are really upset about. I wonder if it comes back next year. It probably will, but I don't think it will be as high a priority. And I wonder what they're going to be able to do with it.
Yeah, I was wondering that as well, because some of these issues, some of these kind of like wedge issues you hear about for a year or two at most, and then they just kind of go away. But there may be people in the caucus that like want to carry them on. Like maybe Jennifer Decker is adamant in trying to make this happen next year. Like I think about like Lindsay Titchener with these like adult businesses bills and parents' rights things and things like that. Like even if the rest of the party has moved on from something. Like, it feels like we're starting to like move on from some of the critical race theory stuff, and now we're on DEI, you know what I mean? So I don't know if it will have the same priority next year, but this bill kind of feels a little bit like what happened last year with Senate Bill 150. We had Senate Bill 150 and House Bill 470, the two anti-trans school legislation bills. The Senate bill was the more like mild one. The House bill was worse. And last year, the bad language, the same thing kind of happened, but the bad language won out. And this time it didn't.
Right. And it turned out that nothing won out.
Yeah.
And another thing, Jasmine, that you mentioned is, you know, those bills that you put in your list of like things that were carried by individual people and continue to be carried, those are bills that have had trouble passing.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about some of them.
Well, let's talk about them.
Yeah. So another one that hasn't made it yet is House Bill 509, which is an open records bill that we have talked about. So this one would require official communications to occur with a required government email, but it would exempt private emails and text messages. You know, there has been a lot of criticism of this bill because it shields private emails and text messages, but I don't think the governor opposes this bill. So if this one passes, it may not get vetoed. Do you think that that's the case, Robert?
It's going to be really interesting to see. You know, the biggest advocates for transparency have like historical beef with the governor, like Amy Benson. We talked about on the show like years and years ago, like Amy Bensonhaver left the attorney general's office when Andy Beshear was the attorney general over transparency issues like this. And you know, it is also, this bill has changed quite a bit. It has become quite a bit more moderate. And it is like a really stark, like, difference of opinion. And I think it's like a pretty legit difference of opinion. If you're operating in an official capacity, what belongs to the public and what exists in the private sphere? And where do you draw those lines? And right now, the state of Kentucky has very stark, if you are doing the public's business, your communications are available for people to see. You know, even if you know they're on your cell phone, or even if they're in your personal email or whatever, there is a very clear sense that like if you want to do something shady, just switch to your personal email and it should be fine.
Right, like it just encourages like that, and I think also with a lot of people working remotely, like we use texting on our cell. On our cell phones for a lot of work communication. And so, yeah.
So it will be, I don't know what's going to happen at the end of the day. We're going to see. It will be interesting to see if they take this up after the veto period and what Governor Beshear does if they do and pass it.
Yeah. So I think this bill, and then there's one other bill that I'm going to mention that I think it will be interesting to see if they're passed after the veto period. So the next one is that we've talked about. Robert did a video about these, and we've talked about them a bit on the show too. House Bill 500, which is Representative Pratt's labor bill, as well as House Bill 255, which is his other one. So House Bill 500 is one that rolls back labor protections, but the most controversial part of it was about lunch breaks and rest periods. That was removed from the bill, but it still does other things like eliminating overtime pay for work on a seventh consecutive day. That bill is dead. And then his child labor bill, that one's House Bill 255. That one it removes a lot of labor protections for 16 and 17 year olds. That one hasn't passed either. I think it could still pass, but I would think that one would be vetoed if it did.
I would expect either one of those, if they got passed, to be vetoed by the governor. Yeah. After the veto period, or if they passed after the veto period, I mean,
Yeah, I don't think House Bill 500 even got, you know, like the readings to pass or anything like that. So I think Philip Pratt's labor bills, I think those are done. This next one I do think is interesting what could happen. This one's House Bill 10 or the Momnibus bill. I did a video about this one. This one started out as a really good bill aiming to expand maternal health care. But shortly before the veto period, provisions from a controversial bill were tacked on to this very bipartisan bill. So a Senate committee approved a new version that added a provision about how hospitals and birthing centers handle non-viable fetuses. And so this bill would now require medical facilities to provide perinatal palliative care or refer parents to those services. And so when this bill was heard in committee, Democratic representatives walked out. And so now these provisions have been added on to this very good and bipartisan Momnibus bill. So I think it'll be interesting to see if this passes with those provisions.
Yeah, most of the people who walked out of that committee hearing are the strongest Democratic supporters of the Momnibus bill. So it just, you know, that's another just like extremely petty, extremely small thing that the Republican majority is imposing on, on Democrats for, you know, trying to do what they can to stand up for their constituents and, you know, stand up for parents that, like us, have been in that situation. It's pretty gross.
And yeah, and I think it puts like the governor in a difficult position as well, because if it does pass with that language, then it puts him in the position of do you want to veto these really good things that we're doing with maternal health care when we have pretty horrible maternal health outcomes in Kentucky with this really bad provision in there. So this is the other one that I think I'm watching to see what happens with it.
That'll be a tough decision for sure. There are so many other like maternal health care things that are getting overlooked. This was just like what they could agree on that they thought they could pass. So is it good enough to merit this like really gross peri whatever?
Yeah. I mean, what it does is all like pretty small in comparison to, you know, what we could be doing. This is what we could get done with a Republican supermajority, but they're all good things, except for this one provision that was added on. So next is House Bill 367, which was a bill that increased eligibility requirements to obtain SNAP benefits. So another bad bill. This passed the House and was assigned. There was a lot of talk about it early in the session. So it passed the House pretty early and was assigned to a committee in the Senate back at the end of February, but no action has been taken on it since. So that's good to hear. Senate Bill 147, which is the adult businesses bill. So it's Lindsay Titchener's bill restricting adult-oriented businesses. It passed the Senate and it has had its second reading in the House. I think this is a bill that if it were to pass, that Beshear would probably veto. It is not, you know, people are still calling this an anti-drag bill, and I would probably still say like it's anti-LGBTQ because of how restrictive it is to things that queer spaces do. But it's not as bad as the bill that she filed last year that basically banned like any form of drag show, it seemed, and would potentially go as far as banning like Shakespeare in the Park if you really enforced it to its full extent. But it looks like this one probably isn't going to make it this year either.
You know, you make the point that it potentially could be seen as less of a drag ban than the year before, And that's maybe true. There is still some kind of like gross stuff involved in it. And
oh, yeah, there absolutely is. It's certainly, I would still say it's an anti-drag bill, even though I'm saying that she claims that it.
Yeah.
That it isn't.
What I guess I'm getting at is to say that if it does pass and Andy Beshear is looking for a good reason to veto it, he can call it an anti-drag bill, even if it's a little better than the one last year, in order to veto it without, you know, paying too much of a price for the other sort of like anti-adult business things that are going on in the bill.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is one of those issues that you mentioned that, you know, a legislator has taken up as their cause that maybe they've had issues getting it across the finish line. And this seems to be one of those for Lindsay Titchener. So that's that one. And then the last one I was going to mention that we've talked about is House Bill 47, which is the RFRA bill. It's a bill broadening or strengthening Kentucky's RFRA, which is the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act. It didn't even make it out of the House. So it seems like that one was really not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. So, I mean, lastly, I wanted to mention a few items that or good bills that are dead or likely dead. First, getting rid of tampon and diaper taxes. We had Cassie Chambers Armstrong on to talk about her diaper tax bill. That unfortunately did not pass. Hadley's Law. I think we knew that David Yates's bill, which was Hadley's Law, that you know, has exceptions for rape and incest, for abortion and things like that. I think we knew that that certainly wasn't going to be a version that passed, but, you know, disappointing to see it didn't even get a committee hearing, and we didn't see any kind of abortion exceptions pass. A crisis aversion and rights retention law. This is a bill, this is a bipartisan sponsored bill that would temporarily remove firearms from someone who's experiencing a mental health crisis. You know, I think this was something that had some bipartisan support in the wake of Louisville's shooting at the National Bank building. But that one,
yeah,
didn't make it either.
These bills have had bipartisan support for years. Typically, often you hear them referred to as red flag laws. But that is, yeah, that is something that has yet to make any traction in the legislature,
yeah,
despite the bipartisan support. Yeah.
Late in the session, we saw some IVF protection bills, after Alabama Supreme Court ruling. And, you know, as predicted by many, you know, abortion and reproductive rights advocates, after Roe was struck down, it was predicted that we might see IVF being threatened. And that has been the case in Alabama. And so bills were filed to protect IVF in Kentucky. But those didn't see, you know, movement in the legislature.
There was one bill, and I talked about this last week. And I forget the number is, 159, HB 159. And it was designed to be like a protection for medical workers bill. And it was, I guess the interpretation of the bill as it was written was that it would like essentially create an indemnification for people who were working in an IVF. And that was at least, it was covered in that way. It isn't as direct. And of course, you could still have a court case. Like, you know, if somebody decided that they wanted to sue because their embryos were destroyed, like that would be probably a much broader case, a much more complicated case than something that if there was a law that was like IVF is protected.
Yeah, which I think those kinds of bills were filed. And
they were. And those are the ones that weren't heard. But there was something that did pass that, you know, is sort of along those lines.
Yeah. That's good to hear, at least the smallest amount of protection. And then a couple other things, Danny Carroll's child care bill. And this was the one you mentioned that, you know, was something that likely wasn't, we weren't able to do it to meet that trigger requirement to reduce the income tax. This was a bill that appropriated a lot of money to help childcare facilities in Kentucky. That one didn't pass. And then finally, paid parental leave, which, you know, was sponsored by a Republican and was a very modest paid parental leave bill, but that didn't pass either. So that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, the paid parental, no, the child care bill that Danny Carroll worked on, that one was really brutal because
it was a huge bill.
It was a big bill, and it had a lot of support, and it seemed like the enough work had been done to justify the need for it. Like, I think that, you know, there were enough Republicans and enough people that worked in childcare and enough research to be like, hey, this is a really big problem, that it seemed like it was likely to pass. And literally, I mean, it is because of those triggers that this didn't pass. It was the cost. It would have pushed the state's budget above the necessary situation to cut taxes. And if that was not there, I really believe this bill would have passed. So it is a true casualty. And our childcare industry, which is facing a significant crisis in the wake of losing that pandemic funding, it will probably experience that crisis because of these silly triggers. So there you go. Jasmine, a lot of stuff did pass. You want to hear about that?
I don't want to.
Well, tough. We're going to talk about it.
But yeah, let's inform our listeners.
Yeah. So the first one I want to talk about is something that happened at the very last second. So they filed these shell bills mostly to just like the way that they do it is kind of funny because like there are a lot of pieces of the Kentucky Revised Statutes that are very old and are not gender neutral. So they're just like he shall or they, you know, him and like whatever. And so they'll just update the language and the bill will be filed to be like he or she or him or her. And so they will be like bill SB 299, updating to gender neutral language. And then they'll remove the bill and insert an entirely new situation, which then is updated to include gender neutral language so that the subject of the bill is still related to the content, etc. So anyways, that's how these things tend to work. SB 299 was a shell bill.
Tricky.
It was. And what this bill does is it removes the horse racing. Actually, It basically gets rid of the Horse Racing Commission and the Department of Charitable Gaming, which are the groups that oversee sports betting and horse racing. And those are currently under the governor's purview. And what the bill does is creates this new independent group, which would be more tightly controlled by the legislature. It was sponsored by Damon Thayer at the very end of the legislative session, and David Osborne, who is the Speaker of the House, helped shepherd it through the House. The vote was significantly closer than many other pieces of legislation. There were 13 Republicans who actually voted against it in the House and 5 Republicans that voted against it in the Senate. But that was not enough to generate stop the bill to from passing. So basically, there is this new independent group that is going to oversee gambling in the state, and it will very little will be under the control of the governor. So that's the first one. Another one. A bill to automatically transfer children who are aged 15 or older to adult court if they are charged with a Class A, B, or C felony while in possession of a firearm passed. Representative Flannery, who introduced the bill in the House, said that the bill was targeted at, quote, very violent criminals, unquote. But Jasmine, anybody that knows you or anybody else that has worked as a criminal defense attorney for children especially can tell you that these criteria will catch a lot of kids who are definitely not what those are very violent criminals, right? I mean, this is pretty bad, this automatic transfer bill, right?
Yeah, and the thing about this bill is that we had automatic transfer for many, many years, and people worked very, very hard to get rid of it, and we just passed a bill to get rid of it just a couple years ago. So We've only had discretionary transfer for a couple years, and there wasn't any increase in juvenile violent crime since then. And now we're bringing it back, and it's incredibly harmful. It I don't think people understand the jump from juvenile court to adult court. It's like you juvenile court, you get this like rehabilitative treatment, and then adult court, you go from that to facing 85% time where you have to serve 85% of your sentence before even being considered for parole. So the minimums there are usually 10 years. So you go from like serving several months in a juvenile justice facility, getting rehabilitative treatment, to 8.5 years in prison, like very quickly at 15.
Yeah. Another thing that I think people don't realize in addition to that is like what counts as like with possession of a firearm, or what some of these class C felonies can be.
Yeah.
Like if there is a gun in the car and you're sitting in the spot where the gun is closest to, basically, I mean, I don't know, you know way more about this than me, but like,
well, it's like the use of a firearm, but that doesn't mean use like shot. So it can be, you know, a robbery where a gun is shown, but the kid who stayed in the car as like the getaway driver with, you know, no prior record, that kid still gets automatically transferred,
right, yeah,
and tried as an adult. And so the other thing about this, the discrepancy from juvenile court to adult prison is huge. And because it's so huge, judges and even some prosecutors in adult court are hesitant to sentence kids to those long prison terms. And so they give them probation or diversion. So sometimes they're not getting that treatment, yeah, that long treatment in the juvenile justice facility. So sometimes it even like makes kind of backfires and they aren't getting that treatment at all. And so, you know, it just results in a lot of really harmful outcomes. And we didn't even like give discretionary waiver like a chance. You know, we only had it for a couple years. And also you could still send any kid who fell under any of this criteria to adult court through the law that we had for, you know, 3 years.
Yeah. It's so crazy. It felt like there was this window where people were more open to, you know, criminal justice reform, or, you know, that sort of situation. And people worked so hard to get such small things, and it just fell apart so quickly.
Yeah. It lasted about 10 years. It was from about like 2011 to 2021, and it is just gone.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's like, that was just the mood. It took like 10 years to get a lot of this stuff passed. Like you said, it took like 6 or 7 years to,
yeah,
get this automatic transfer bill overturned or repealed. Yeah. And then just a few years later, it just passed without much.
But violent crime hasn't increased. Like, I don't know like what it is.
I mean, other than
racism, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's always kind of been there. I feel like the mood of just like people's response to the murder rate has gone up in the past few years. It's plateaued and is likely coming back down. I mean, the perceived crime rate has increased, even though the actual crime rate hasn't gone up. And the reasons for that are sociological and definitely like steeped in racism. And there's all kinds of things behind it. But yeah, it is just really sad to watch all of this stuff happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like largely the response to 2020, which I attribute largely to racism. So that's
totally fair. I think you're probably right about that. HB 388 was a bill that I talked about last week. I'm still going to call it the War on Louisville bill, even if Anthony Piacentini tells me not to. That bill did pass. I talked about it last week. The House eventually concurred with the Senate version. So that means that there's going to be nonpartisan elections for mayor and metro council. It's going to be harder to build affordable housing in Louisville, and it will be more difficult to discipline police officers. Those are the three big things that were happening. So that's pretty bad.
It's already hard to do.
Yeah.
that stuff.
It's crazy that even, you know, the United States Department of Justice puts the police department under a consent decree, and the state government decides to make it more difficult to punish bad police officers. So that's where we're at. That's the government that Jason Nemes wants us to have. And so that's, you know, he's got the power to basically do whatever he wants, because he's got, you know, 60 or 70 Republicans from outside of Louisville to just basically follow his guide as to what Louisville should do. So that's where we're at. I mean, it's going to have a massive difference in terms of Metro Council. Metro Council has been organized around partisan caucuses forever, and their staffing is based around partisan caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much stuff that's like based around the partisanship of that chamber, or of that legislative body, and that's going to go away. And I don't really know what it's going to look like, and I don't think they know what it's going to look like. It's going to be very different. I don't think it's going to be better. It's going to be worse in some ways that they don't really perceive of. So, yeah, that was HB 388. There was a bill that removes the power of the governor to appoint a successor in the event of a United States Senate vacancy. And that passed pretty easily in the last day of the session. Only 4 members of the House, all of whom were Democrats, and just 3 senators, also all Democrats, opposed the measure. So it was a pretty significant bipartisan majority that passed this bill. And I guess the reason why Democrats decided to vote for it, by and large, is they kind of foresee a future with a Republican governor and a Republican legislator where the best kind of outcome is to have a special election. Like, you're definitely not going to get a Democrat if it's, you know, the Republican legislature and the Republican governor that's putting somebody in place. But if there is a special election, it at least gives you a chance. I don't know. That's at least what I came up with. I also don't think that they think that Mitch McConnell is going to resign, but I guess this gives him the option to do so. You know, maybe also they're just trying to encourage him to do that. Please leave. All right. That's that one. HB 278 is a relatively relatively non-controversial bill to increase penalties for child sexual assault and abuse. But at the last second, the Senate inserted a provision that required pornographic websites to verify the ages of their users. These provisions have been passed in a lot of other states and have caused some of the larger, you know, porn sites to block those states from accessing their sites. So Senator Jay Williams said that his goal in inserting those provisions was to stop pornographic sites from operating in Kentucky. There's a lot of really thorny, like, privacy and First Amendment issues that probably, you know, require some discussion in a bill like this. Not to say that, you know, this isn't the right or wrong decision. I actually don't know. I mean, I think that there is, like, some discussion, some conversation that can be had and probably needed to be had around this, but it wasn't had. They inserted this at the very last second to a bill that had strong bipartisan support, passed it, and sent it back to the House, who then concurred because they only had a couple of hours before the session was going to expire. So, you know, this is a pretty significant change to our laws around the operation of these kind of websites. So, I don't know what's going to happen. This is definitely something that likely will catch a lot of people unaware when it starts to be enforced. Get a lot of really interesting people excited about state government in a way they might not have been before. So, I don't know, Jasmine, anything to say about that?
I don't know. It seems like if they just, like, had talked about this more and thought this out, then it's something that they could have passed after the veto period, because Bashir likely wouldn't veto it.
I mean, I think that's probably right. I mean, but they likely didn't want to risk it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, I don't know. Whitney Westerfield, you know, you could see, like, the consternation in his face, because he was just kind of like, he voted for it, but he was like, there's a lot of issues here. And I mean, you could see him be like, we should talk about this more. This is really something we should talk about more before we just do it. But, you know, what are you going to do? They do the things that they do. They're extremely sloppy. They're extremely non-transparent. And this is how our state government operates now. So that is that. All right. A couple of smaller ones here at the end. HCR, the House Continuing Resolution 81, which is a resolution that establishes a task force to study JCPS, something we knew that was coming. It's likely going to propose splitting up the district, and that passed. Four Republicans eventually voted against it in the House, and it was a totally partisan vote in the Senate. So no Republicans voted against it in the Senate. So, you know, maybe it's not a foregone conclusion. I feel like it is, though. They're going to come back and say, you should split it up. And then a few years after that, they're going to give it a real shot. Jasmine, I don't really know. The way that they wrote up this bill, definitely it was like, should study how school districts of more than 75,000 students operate. And I don't know if the special legislation piece of the Constitution comes into play for continuing resolutions, but I feel like it might, and this might be something that they can sue about. I guess it would be tough to show harm, maybe. I don't know, but this is... That's definitely has the feeling of special.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the application of resolutions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be a good state constitutional law question for someone.
Yeah. And I'm springing this question on you. That's a big and hard question. The last second. So we'll see. We'll see. It could be something that we hear more about in the near future. All right. HB 825. Wow, that's a large number. 825. That proposes an audit of the Kentucky Department of Education, and it passed without any opposition, and I found that quite surprising. The KDE is audited on a pretty regular basis. I don't know why it might need a special audit, but it was something that passed pretty much wasn't unanimous because there were some people that didn't vote because they weren't there, but there was no opposition to this bill. So the KDE is highly likely to get some sort of audit. So... yeah, that's that. Andy Beshear just started issuing his vetoes yesterday. That's probably a big chunk of what we're going to be talking about in the next couple of shows during the veto period. But we'll talk about that when they come. Jasmine, what was your biggest surprise in the things that passed in the waning hours of the legislative session?
In the things that did pass?
Yeah.
Probably the War on Louisville bill, just because
it's been out there so many times and
They've been trying to do it for so long, and it just felt like it was one of those things that I've just been pretending was never going to happen.
Yeah, you know,
and I was like, oh dang it, they did it. did it this time.
The role of the mayor, Mayor Greenberg, in this is something that is a bit of a mystery, and there has been some controversy bandied about to say, you know, he supported this. I don't think that was I definitely don't feel like it was a direct support. I think it was kind of more of like, if we get some of these things into HB1 that we need from state funding, like, I won't stand in the way, I won't whip votes in opposition or something like that. And it might be one of those things where, like, the mayor kind of, like, let it happen. Or, you know, I don't know. It could have been, like, a direct support thing. And there's definitely some people out there who have that view of the mayor. They're not necessarily me. But, yeah, that is that was very surprising. That was very surprising, the fact that it did eventually happen. Yeah, I think that the porn sites one's going to – I think that one's got the best chance to have some downstream unexpected impacts that they don't realize are coming. So we'll see about that. Yes. All right. Some quick hits before we leave, Jasmine. There were multiple tornadoes that tore through Kentucky yesterday. I think there were like two in the Louisville area, and I think there were a few more in other places. Yeah. So, you know, Governor
Beshear, Henry County.
Yeah. Henry County. It was like Northeast Jefferson County out to Henry County. I don't know if Oldham County got any, but yeah, Henry County, which is north of there, definitely did.
Yeah, like Crestwood, I think. I don't know if they had a tornado, but they were kind of like in that path.
Yeah. Governor Beshear and Mayor Greenberg have issued a state of emergency, so I hope everybody managed to stay safe. I was driving on the road and missed this entirely. So good for me. My house was still standing. Jasmine, did you like hide in your, you don't have a basement. Did you?
Have a basement. No, I was in the middle of cooking dinner when the tornado sirens went off, and I like looked at the weather and saw that it was just northeast of me. And I was like, it's fine. It's like 5 minutes north, so I'm good.
Well, I'm glad that you came through it unscathed. That's good. And we're thinking of everybody that did not get through it unscathed. Although I don't think there were any fatalities, so that's good.
There was one in Campbellsville.
Oh, really?
From a car accident, you know, from the storms.
Well, that's very sad for that family in Campbellsville. Jasmine, I talked at length about the JCPS's school board's vote to end transportation and magnet schools last week. When I was recording it, I was like, you will know the end of this by the time you listen to it, because it's happening while I'm recording. The board actually decided to table their decision. So we don't know what happened. We will probably be talking about it again. That's good. I think having some more time to think about it gives us a chance to make it not happen. And I think we should do what we can to try to keep magnet transportation happening, because making the schools as accessible as possible is really important to me as a graduate of a magnet program. Jasmine, anything else to say this week?
Nope, I think that's it.
Woof, that was a lot. So
we've been going for an hour.
We have. All right, well, Jasmine, tell people how they can get a hold of us.
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @myoldkypod. They can like our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. We have a Facebook page, and you can subscribe to our newsletter at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. We also have a Patreon page where you can support what we're doing for as little as a dollar a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And last but not least, we're part of the Dimcast Network and the Ford Kentucky Network.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. I go down to the holler.